On today's show, we look ahead to the new year and the new laws the government has in store for us. We look back at the millions of dollars spent on ridiculous things last year. And finally, a mole helps a kraken save a canuck. This is Penhold Talk Radio. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for coming back. Happy New Year. My name is Brian Constantine. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
Let's start off with some good news. Over in Italy, they, of course, celebrated the New Year. And particularly in Naples, they had a really good time. Video was going around social media with fireworks going across the city. Like, it was amazing. And, like, the whole town was just like, literally just looked like on fire with fireworks.
It almost looked like an accident. It kind of looked like a whole bunch of people's supply just accidentally went off. It went wild.
And conveniently, all those accidents were scattered throughout the town. Now we bring that story up because in Naples, for the second year in a row, the government there actually had banned fireworks. And so this video, and I'll try to find it and upload it there to the video version of this podcast, so you can see it and enjoy the wonder of citizenry exercising their firework freedom. it is a beautiful sight to see, very heartwarming to see people flouting such silly laws. Now, of course, there's restrictions to flouting silly laws, but this is one I will happily endorse. There's just been too many silly laws put on the books this year, and the silliest part of it is, of course, the fireworks ban has nothing to do with the danger of fireworks. Like, that might actually give you certain grounds for doing that,
but banning it because of COVID,
yes,
it's probably one of the safer activities as far as COVID goes. So let people enjoy their fireworks.
That was a ridiculous law based on a ridiculous premise. So I'm glad they exercised their freedom there. And it was a beautiful sight to see.
And it looks like it was a pretty good portion of the city.
It wasn't
one family.
No, this was not the one guy in the backyard of Penhold here shooting off fireworks.
So good for them.
But this was citywide, and it was good encouragement to start the new year that not everyone is lying down taking these restrictions. All right. So as we teed up in the intro, we're going to start by looking at some new laws that are coming onto the books this year. Of course, what is a government without laws? And so quite a few are being changed. Some of them are good. Some of them are necessary. Let's start right here in Penhold. So the last council meeting before the new year, town council was starting to enact their budget planning for this upcoming year. And so one part of that is having to update some bylaws, particularly if you're changing the utility rate. So there's a utility bylaw that kind of governs what the rate is that we pay on our utilities. Mm-hmm. Now the council, it's kind of a council tradition now that they brag about how they aren't raising the kind of the base town rate, the tax rate.
Yeah. It's kind of been an ongoing theme to the council for probably a good 5 or 6 years now, where they're bragging about keeping the tax rates down.
And good. Yeah. The less money the government can take from me, the better. They should only take exactly what is necessary. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not a lot. But as government grows, they're going to take more.
Yeah.
So the base rate is staying the same, but the utility rates are going to be going up for the town in this next year. So if you look at your utility rates, the fixed fee for water and sewer are both going up. So as Michael pointed out before we started recording, there's a fixed fee that you pay on water and sewer. And then on top of that, it seems you pay a metered rate.
Yeah. Yeah, and in Penhold, that metered rate starts right from the first drop of water out of your tap. Some municipalities will include a certain amount in the fixed rate. Ours is you pay your fixed rate, and then you pay usage entirely above that.
Yeah, so even if you don't use a drop of water, you're going to be paying that base rate. So that base rate is going up almost $2 to $17.30 a month. So that's an increase of about 12%. The sewer or the fixed sewer rate is going up to $14.75 a month. That's an increase of $2.75.
Yeah.
And that's actually an increase. So that's an increase of 23% on that. Is that right? Did I get my math right on that? Yeah.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Because otherwise it's $12. And so $2.75. Yeah. It's right there. So yeah, that's not, when you put in the percentages, this is why I did the percentages. Cause it doesn't seem a lot when you just put it in like $2, like who's going to miss $2?
Less than $3 a month.
Yeah. Like
what's that?
Yeah. It's a coffee.
23% increase.
Yeah. And so it's important to kind of think, recognize the scale that these things are jumping on. So those are your fixed rates. Both of those are going up. The metered rates are going up slightly. They're going up 5% on the water and 2% on the sewer. And then it's worth mentioning though that the garbage is going down $1. Is going down to $22 a month for garbage. So that's down $1. And so what that means is that overall, when you average this out, the average household is going to be paying about $5.30 a month, as the council has calculated. So a little bit more than $60 per year extra on your utilities this year,
which isn't a lot. And some of that it's fair to point out that some of that is out of the hands of the Penhold council. Things like our sewer is run through the regional sewer system that all runs through Red Deer. Mm-hmm. And so there's certain aspects of that that we don't get much choice on.
Yeah. A lot of these seems to be just trying to keep up with some of the operating costs of these, and then of course put inflation on top of that.
Yeah.
And you can understand how even as diligent as this council seems to desire to keep rates as low as possible, there's just some reality checks that are hitting home.
Yeah.
That costs are going up on the maintenance and just on overall products across the board. And so these are some of these increase in costs are no doubt attributed to that.
Yeah.
And then related to that, next year, council's getting us prepared because the provincial government changed how they're structuring the funding for policing. And so now it's kind of based upon, I believe, the population of a city or a town.
Yeah.
And so that cost is now being incurred directly by the town councils or the city councils. They have to bring in that revenue now, instead of it kind of being a provincial fund being paid out. Mm-hmm. And so next year they're anticipating a likely increase of 1% to cover those policing costs. And the way this is structured, at least again, from the provincial level, it seems like these costs are going to go up at least over the next couple of years. And so don't be surprised if you see kind of a little bit of an incremental growth in taxes over the next 3 or 4 years.
And that's going to be universal across the province. It's not Penhold getting hit by this. This is going to be happening everywhere. It's just the way they're restructuring those fees.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's not on council per se for this. And it's certainly not unique to Penhold. I think it's worth noting that council has been vocal in kind of advocating if we are going to be paying these extra costs, or at least paying these in this way. It just seems like this, like we're going to have to pay more overall, and probably it's going to be the case. My cynical side says, well, this should just wash out, right? The provincial government is just transferring the funds down to the provincial, or down to the kind of municipal level. And so my provincial taxes are going to go down.
You would think
that, but yeah, of course not.
But by shuffling it, the provincial ones stay the same and the municipal ones go up.
Yeah. And so it's hiding a provincial tax increase more than a municipal one. But council has been vocal, I think, in trying to advocate if we are going to be paying these extra amounts, we better be getting something for it. And I think that's how all taxes should be viewed.
Yeah.
That's how we, that's the whole economic system is it's a trade for goods and services.
Yeah. If we're paying you for this, we want to see what the results are.
Yeah. Yeah. And so good on council for that. Hopefully they keep up that advocacy. Another thing locally worth highlighting, I think, and just cause this is kind of one of those fascinating big picture kind of perhaps maybe things that are kind of going on. But council is kind of, council themselves, or at least someone from the town, is going to be meeting up with a group that's promoting high-speed rail. This group is looking for kind of municipal support, I'm imagining, for the corridor between Calgary and Edmonton primarily.
Yeah.
To get municipalities, towns on board for I guess possible high speed rail coming through this area, which, like I said, this is kind of, it feels more like a dream at this point.
But the fact that they're bringing it to municipalities now, like, this has been in the works, like talks about it have been going on for years. Like, I'm pretty sure it's probably 15 years now that they've been talking about some kind of high speed rail system between Edmonton and Calgary.
Yeah.
And now they're finally getting to that point where somebody, I don't know who this group is, but somebody's coming through and talking to the municipalities and trying to get something rolling. So, and I know that I think the provincial government has talked with organizations about doing it, and there's things happening. So this could be big, and it's just kind of a cool thing to see happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine a high speed rail stop at the junction 42, you know, that's kind of an interesting thought to think about.
Hop on and head to Edmonton in a matter of minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Half hour down to Edmonton, who knows, or up to Edmonton, down to Calgary. But yeah, no, it's just, like I said, something interesting to think about. And maybe a little bit of kind of a future thinking. Like, it's nice to, who knows if this will ever materialize, but I like this approach. It doesn't seem like it costs anything, it's future looking. You don't want to be stuck necessarily in status quo. And so this just, I think it's nice to see council having a little bit of a forward vision on some of these things. And then, finally, in Penhold here, again, just a nice little, this is one thing that, is kind of one of these kind of local small town kind of things.
Yeah.
So last winter, if you recall, you perhaps woke up and found a package on your doorstep from the town. It was their winter warm-up package.
Right. Yeah.
They sent those out to everyone. I think it was because was the fall festival that was canceled, or
no, it was probably their winter fest that they usually do in, I think in February, had to be canceled. So they sent out packages to a number of households.
Yeah. So they used the funds that they would normally spend on that.
Yeah.
On the winter packages. And part of that was a recipe card that people could fill out. And so finally, and the town admits this is taking a little bit longer, but nonetheless, you can now go onto the town website and find the Penhold Community Cookbook. So it has a whole bunch of different appetizers, main courses, desserts. And it's a fun little read through. It gives you a little glimpse into kind of the different communities and even backgrounds of people.
Yeah.
That are in this area. And it's, like I said, it feels like a fun small town thing.
Yeah. And they left it all as like scans of people's handwriting. So it's got such a small town community feel. Like, you just feel like this is something the neighbors created.
That's right.
It was really neat.
Yeah. So it's just a digital file that you can access directly on the website. And as Michael pointed out, it's just, and they've scanned in the actual recipe cards, and so everyone's handwriting is still present.
Yeah,
so they're all very personalized.
You see some that are obviously written by kids, and some that were fancy handwriting that I could never do, and it's just neat.
Yeah. All right, so that's kind of the changes that are going on in Penhold. Looking a little bit wider, there are a number of new laws coming in place across the country. Probably the most notable one, or at least we've talked about it a couple times now on the podcast, is that beginning January 7th, the new conversion therapy ban is enacted. So this is the one that passed through the House of Commons and the Senate unanimously, right at first reading. So this didn't. Yeah. So I think from the time it was tabled to the time it passed was like maybe a month.
Yeah.
I think it was even less than that. But that officially becomes law January 7th. So now if you come across a practice, treatment or service, I think is the language, that is in any way, attempting to convert, someone from say homosexual, feelings or attractions to heterosexual, to heterosexual or from trans to cisgender, that's now illegal. And in fact, imprisonable, you can be imprisoned for up to 5 years now for that. Now remember this is regardless of whether or not the person wants this treatment or not.
Yeah. It doesn't allow even seeking out that treatment.
Yeah. No, yeah. And so this isn't someone being kicked and dragged off to a service they don't want. Like even if there was someone who wanted treatment, they want to change from these feelings that they have. They don't desire them.
Yeah.
At least homosexual attractions. They don't want them. They can't go and talk to a pastor. They can't go talk to their priest, their imam. Like this isn't just a Christianity thing. This is a lot wider than that. That's now illegal. The kind of the interesting thing about this law is that though, if you want to talk to, if you want to kind of move from kind of a heterosexual position to homosexual, that's okay.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to rehash everything we've talked about on the past podcast. It is just, I want to highlight again though, that this bill is written so broadly that it's unclear what it actually encompasses, like what's its limits. So is a parent talking to his child or his child against the law? Is a pastor preaching on Sunday against the law? There just doesn't seem to be any kind of restrictions, clear laid out restrictions or limitations on this law. And it very easily could have been limited, but it wasn't. And partly I think that the fact that it's written so broadly is the reason for that is seen in the preamble to this bill, mm-hmm. which calls kind of what normal or normative sexuality and genders and a myth. And remember, this is the view that men and women are different and not changeable. Like that's the view that's considered a myth, the view that's been held by humanity from the start, wherever you want to put the start. Like this has just been part of every society.
Yeah.
Like across the board. This has kind of been the normative view of it. And yet somehow we've come to this enlightened view that that's all been a myth. And not only is that a myth, but the preamble actually sets it out as a danger, as a harm yeah. to society. So if you believe that men and women are uniquely different, that there are specific genders, that there are unchangeable things between men and women, that's now a harmful myth that you are espousing.
Yeah.
And that's the danger of, I think, of this law more than the actual law itself is kind of the premise, the foundation behind it. And so kind of in this, just to give a highlight later, just to point out how significant this is, like this is getting traction down in the US. Like this bill has not gone unnoticed internationally. And I think overall, not surprisingly, it's probably received favorable reviews in mainstream media.
Yeah.
Cause this just fits that kind of woke progressive leftist culture, or at least leftist direction that culture is going in. But big names in particularly in kind of the Christian field in the States have spoken out against this. And even obviously in Canada as well. perhaps the, probably the biggest one, at least that I'm aware of, is John MacArthur. He's pastored a mega church down in California there for 50 years now.
Yeah. One of the most prominent writers and preachers in the US right now.
Yeah. And especially in evangelical circles. Mm-hmm. But on January 16th, a number of churches are going to be preaching on biblical sexuality in response to this.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, there's going to be churches in Canada and the US that are going to be, speaking against the dangers of this bill. And like I said, primarily the justification that's being used here, cause that it's a radical, like this is almost more of a religious document than a bill that you would expect to see. Because when you look at scripture, it gives instructions about what sexuality should be. And you look at the preamble to
that's exactly the bill, what they're doing.
It's doing the exact same thing. Like, what difference does it make to say that what's said in the Bible is religious, but this isn't? They're both making claims about what reality is or what should be, and what good and proper beliefs are. They're both making these kind of big foundational statements about things and how men and women and just society should operate. And so, yeah, I think it's not, don't be surprised when religious people speak out against particularly a religious position, which I think this bill takes. So yeah, that bill is coming, is becoming law now. The bill is now a law starting on January 7th. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out long term. Obviously, no doubt there's going to be there's going to be court filings. I know there's already people setting up for legal challenges to this bill and this law. So this is not the end of this conversation. This is going to continue on.
Yeah, like you said, with how vague the law is, we'll have to see what the courts do with it.
Yeah, that's really going to end up kind of being the defining. I think defining the parameters of this bill, because it has been left wide open at this point.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, that's one bill coming in on the national scale. There's a few more just kind of quickly run through, just kind of get you prepared. Some of these things you just be aware of, particularly if you want to take a picnic this year. On the national scale, there's going to be a ban on single-use plastic coming in sometime in 2022. This initially was planned for 2021. But now it's back online. It's going to be implemented sometime this year. And so this is going to ban single-use plastic, and specifically six different kinds. It's going to ban checkout bags, stir sticks, beverage rings. So these are the kind of the six ring or the plastic rings you find around your six packs, cutlery. So this is your plastic cutlery that you might bring out to your picnics
or get every time you buy food that requires cutlery at a restaurant.
Yeah. Like yeah, exactly.
Place, yep. Anywhere else that's going to be banned.
Yep. Straws, I guess plastic straws more specifically.
You can keep using those wet Kleenex paper ones if you want.
yeah. And then certain food packaging. So this is, I think, primarily the kind of the styrofoam takeout kind of food. And I think looking at these items, one reason it was probably pushed back to this year was because of a lot of the restrictions that were put in place last year that required a lot of these things to be used.
Yeah, suddenly with COVID, they weren't accepting reusable cups at fast food places, and they weren't accepting all these things. So then what?
Yeah,
they weren't prepared for it.
No, especially with the rapid change that were going on. One reason they went with these six is because they believe that there's environmental and economical alternatives to this. You can be the determiner of that, whether you prefer your plastic bags to your paper bags, or your plastic straws to your paper straws. For me, the straws are not working yet.
That's
that technology has not caught up.
That's the one on this list I look at and say, no, we can't get rid of those yet. Every time I get a paper straw in a cup of pop at a restaurant or at the theater or something like that. The theater is the
one that kills me.
Yeah, you can't make it 20 minutes into a movie before you're sucking through like basically Kleenex. Like it's just gone soft and losing pieces. And
Especially, you know, if you sit down to a Marvel movie, especially, you know, you got that 2.5 hours, your straw is not going to last. Yeah. It's not, you better be putting that thing in like at most halfway through. Cause that straw is not going to make you make it through a Marvel movie. Even an hour and a half Pixar, you might have, you're going to be struggling, I think. But yeah, get ready for that. That ban is coming in place, apparently sometime this year. On more provincial level, BC, is implementing a permanent 5-day paid sick leave, legislation. So whether you are, temporary, whether you're part-time or full-time, as long as you've employed, at least 90 days, you are entitled to 5 days of sick pay. I'm assuming this is on an annual basis. Like I don't think this is 5 days at a time, but I think on an annual basis, you get 5 days paid sick leave. Like I said, as long as you've worked 90 days. So
that's a pretty short period of time.
It's a short period of time. It opens up to a lot of workers. So much so that this is estimated to cost $500 million to $1.1 billion annually.
And that's just in BC.
This is just BC. Like, I know I had to double check that because that just seemed like crazy amount of money. But that's what one of the federations is estimating. And one small restaurant guy that they quoted in the article. So this is going to cost them $30,000 a year.
It's basically another employee.
An entire employee. He's like, yeah, I'm going to have to pass those costs on. Like, I might have to raise my prices off under this. And this is how you're going to end up with even more inflation in the end. And prices going up because the cost has to be passed on. Someone has to pay for that. And with this started as a temporary COVID program.
Yeah.
So this was meant to kind of, you know, if people had COVID, they had to take they had 3 days sick pay that the government was helping at least fund that. It doesn't seem like there's anything that it seems like all of this is going to be placed on the businesses. I don't know. I don't think there's any, at least I was trying to read the article closely. I didn't read that the funding was going to continue like it was for the COVID.
Yeah, I get the impression this is just a change to basically the provincial labor laws saying that employers are required to give this. This is not the government saying that we will fund 5 days of paid sick time. So you're telling every employer that you are now required to pay somebody even if they don't come to work if they're sick.
Yes. That's 5 days. BC Labor Federation, something like that. BC Labor Federation, they're arguing for 10 days of paid sick leave, and they don't even like the whole 90 day segment. Like you have to be employed for 90 days. They want 10 days paid sick leave on the backs of the employers.
And it sounds great for the employees. I can understand from an employee perspective, you're looking at it and saying, well, I get sick and suddenly I can't pay my bills. But now you're just moving that same argument over to the employer, which for a big corporation, whatever, they can handle it.
Yeah.
But every small business is going to look at this and say, well, that's going to cost me a fortune. Yeah. I'm going to be paying a lot more money if suddenly I have to give sick time to all of my part-time workers.
Yeah. That's probably where the most hurt is going to be is the people who are already just operating on those thin margins already, especially the restaurant business. And this is on top of, all the ongoing, restrictions already, health restrictions, whether they can bring people in for dine-in service or not. This is, I think is a hard hit for many businesses. Mm-hmm. And I guess just to put the argument that's being made here is that no one should lose their work or their job because they got sick. And you know, for what it's worth, sure, okay. Especially if you know, if you come down with the flu and you have to take some days off, I don't think that's justification for losing your job.
Yeah.
And I don't think that really happens. I think if you're perpetually sick, you might have issues with your employment because they are trying to employ you to do something.
Employee.
Yeah, you need to.
Yeah.
So I think in those hypothetical scenarios in which people are getting fired for getting the flu, I don't think that happens. But if it does, sure, okay. But I don't see this being a realm for the government to intrude on. This should be this, like, to me, if I'm an employer, I would if I'm able to do this, then I'm going to be upfront with this. Like, yeah. This is going to be how I separate myself out from the other guy.
It becomes a perk of one exactly. Working for your company. You yes. are the company that is willing to pay when you're sick so that you don't go unpaid for a paycheck. Like it becomes something good that employer does, not something they're forced to do that, like you say, for the small ones working on a small margin that could push them out of business.
Yeah. And this is one way how businesses can compete. You want the good employees, you offer them these kind of perks and benefits and you'll get the good employees.
Yeah.
But now this just hits
retention.
Yeah.
If they can get the same perks by going to the next place down the street, then why would they stay with you?
Yep. Yeah. If they know that you as an employer have a reputation for firing people who get sick,
they're not going to go there.
Yeah. That those businesses aren't going to last long just on that premise alone.
But now the government is forcing them to function that
yeah.
with those supposed perks.
Government mandated perks now. And I guess the last thought and this kind of, again, trying to burrows down to more of a fundamental ideas behind some of these. Again, I think there's good intention here. But I'm concerned by kind of the unspoken fundamental beliefs that often get kind of shoehorned into these things.
Yeah.
And here's the question I have. How does one sickness entitle them to another person's money? So if I get sick, why does my employer have to give me their money? Because that's basically what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you're looking at the small businesses, that really is their livelihood that they're paying you when you're sick.
Yeah. I don't see how that makes any sense.
Nope.
Like I'm not giving my employer has hired me to do something for them. And when I'm sick, I'm not giving them any benefit. There's no exchange of goods and services going on here. So why do I get their money in that situation? But that just does not seem to be a thought here. And the other crazy thing is, okay, why does the government get to impose that I must give that? Like, there's kind of two layers here, you know, just on the fundamental level, why does my sickness entitle me to get your money? But what authority does the government say gets to come in and play police officer and say, if you don't, there'll be fines or punishment if you don't give this sick person money.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre when you think about it. And I think in those terms, I just don't understand why these things don't get thought in more complex ways. It just seems like there's a lot of superficial thinking in this. It's like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that.
Yeah. We see sick people not getting paid. That hurts them. We should help them.
Yes.
And that's as far as the thought process goes.
Yeah. And you know, you can keep going further. You know, here's a problem. Who must solve it? Well, the government must solve it.
Yeah.
That keeps going deeper and deeper down this rabbit hole. But look at deeper through these issues. I think you find they get even more ridiculous. Or you can just look past the kind of the good intentions there. Often put forward for some of these laws, like the next one here. So out of Saskatchewan, starting July 1st, it is mandatory to have smoke and carbon monoxide detectors in all residences. So basically, if someone sleeps in that building, there has to be a smoke and carbon monoxide detector. Now, this isn't talking about new builds. That's already kind of been in place for at least a decade or two.
Yeah,
now, depending on the smoke detectors and carbon
monoxide. That's been building code for a while.
Yeah. What this is doing is it requires every building that has occupants to have smoke detector and carbon monoxide detectors in it. At the responsibility of the residences.
Yeah.
So you now have to fund it in order to be up to code in this way. Now, and for me, this feels kind of like a seatbelt law to me.
Yeah.
It's like, should you have smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors?
Absolutely.
Of course, duh, right? But why is it the government's responsibility to mandate that? And apparently they'll come check. Like they're any good law has to be enforced in some way. And they there will be inspections from time to time. I don't know what that looks like. They aren't very clear on that.
Yeah. It's...
But that's what's gonna happen according to the article. And all these articles I'll link again back to penholetalkradio.ca. I put all of our kind of sources and articles that we're reading from on there if you want to take a look at it. And so you're going to have to have the government some way of checking in whether or not you have smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors in your house. And that to me seems like government overreach 101. Like it's one of those, this is a good idea to have it, but it's not a good idea for the government to enforce it or to mandate it. Mm-hmm. This is in the realm of individual responsibility. And I think this concern is justified. And this is interesting because it ties into all kind of the health concerns that are going on and health restrictions, because the government relations minister, Don Morris from Saskatchewan, this is his quote. It says, "The health, welfare, and safety of residences in their homes is a priority in building safe communities and a strong Saskatchewan." I think this is true. The health, welfare, and safety of residences in their home, it should be a priority, but for who and to what extent?
Yeah.
Like this is the government official saying that this is a priority of the government, that you are safe in your own home.
How far do they take that? Like,
I don't see where the limitation is built into that principle or into this statement. Like, and this is what I mean, tying it to COVID. This is the exact same kind of argument that's being made about all the health restrictions, is that we're just doing this for public health safety.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all well and good. Where do I get to say what happens in my own home? Like if this is the kind of the government mandate, then this is wide open. And that's unsettling, at least, if nothing else. Like is the government going to come in and make sure, that all my plugs have grounding to it, I'm using the proper dish detergent or something?
Yeah.
Like, or is that my dish detergent is sealed up and so the kids don't eat the laundry pods or something? Like, you can take this in all sorts of ridiculous directions, but it's ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous because it fits within this framework that they just mentioned. It's about the safety of residences isn't in their home. Okay. That's you've opened the barn door huge here when you start operating like this. There's just no limit. There's no built-in limit to that.
Then any activity that has any inherent risk has to be controlled and monitored or eliminated.
Yeah, I mean, at a government level.
Yeah,
that's not a direction. Like I said, we're talking about foundational views here. This is kind of a highlighting a foundational view, and then just looking down the road of where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get off that road? Like there might be good intentions down this road, but those are for the individual. It's a road that should be traveled by the individual, not the government.
Yeah.
The government vehicle is way too wide. He's going to wreck everything going down that road. Let the individual worry about some of these things. Not every problem requires a government solution. I think that's a simple principle here.
Yeah. And I know we've said it before that not all good is good that the government should be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
It may be a good thing. Telling somebody that, yes, you should have a smoke and carbon monoxide detector. Yeah, you should. But that's not a good that is government responsibility.
Yeah. All right. So finally, in Alberta, of course, we are not without new laws. In near the end of the year of 2021, there was a big press conference and revealing of the new federal funding deal for daycare and to help cover the cost of daycares. And so some of those costs and part of that deal becomes enacted now in January. Apparently daycare costs on average are going to be started to be lowered, perhaps even cut in half, I think, according to the article, beginning in January. So if you use daycare, it looks like you'll be seeing some savings. And the idea is to push daycare down to a $10 per day threshold. This is a tricky one, because this is, I think, a very popular popular legislation. So all I really want to say about this is I'm concerned about the direction society is taking towards family, and particularly parents and child or child relationships. There seems to be an emphasis on trying to get parents, particularly mothers, into the workplace.
Yeah.
And that's fine if they want to work, kind of in, you know, out there in the workforce. But things like this have kind of that subtle push towards, well, we'll make it easier for you not to look after your kids. Like, yeah. It sounds harsh. That's what I mean. If this funding is helping you provide for your family, that's one thing. Like, if you're a single parent and this is how you get by, good. I really don't have any issues. What I'm concerned with is with kind of the ease and the overall philosophy that's behind this.
Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of this, especially with Trudeau and his ridiculous she session talk about how women have left the workforce more than men during the whole pandemic. And there's a push to try to get them back in. Some of these are mothers, I think, that have just enjoyed the fact that they get to stay home and look after their kids.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of pressure, I think, a lot of societal pressure. And cost and things like this just make it easier. If you make something easier for people, they'll take advantage of it. That's just universal. More people will take advantage of it. So if it's one thing if someone relies upon it for looking after their family, what this does is it makes it easier for people who might, you know, maybe on the threshold of things, or maybe this just makes it easier for them to get back to work. They don't have to go back to work. They want to get back to work. And this just makes it an affordable way for someone to look after their kids. It's that kind of mentality that makes me nervous, mm-hmm. about the importance of parenting and importance of particularly mothers, and especially at kids in younger ages.
Yeah.
There's other studies that kind of just reinforce the significance of mothers, particularly at a younger age. And these, as much as they might be necessary for some, I feel it shouldn't be made especially accessible to those who don't necessarily need it.
And we already have systems in place that subsidize childcare for low income. Like there's already things out there, and maybe those can be improved upon, like, yeah, to make it easier for, like you say, the single mother that needs to support her kids. Great. We need to help that.
Yeah.
Again, there's debate about how far government should go with everything, but that's great. But when you just make it easy for everyone, like you say, you may not even need to go back to work financially or anything, but this just makes it that much easier to get back into the workforce and have somebody else take care of your children.
Yeah.
There's an ideology there that I find unsettling.
Yeah. It's a priority shift that's going on. So that's what, yeah, I mean, the single mother who requires assistance to make funds to support her family. That's one thing. Cause I think she's still doing it for her kids.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, I think, that thinking, like, kids are almost a burden to adults. And if I can get, they're impeding my career, they're impeding me being a productive member of society because I don't have don't bring in a paycheck or something like that.
Yeah. We don't consider being a stay-at-home parent a productive member of society. That's the shift that we've gotten to where
at least it's not made explicit. It's not celebrated in the same way as the working mother
used to be, and now the working mother is celebrated more than the mother who takes care of her children.
You just don't hear a lot of talk about it in this way because it's such a popular thing, and it's hard to speak against something that's helping out a lot of people who do need it. But I think there's a lot of people who take the advantage of this out of a different kind of mentality than I need this to support my family, more as I want to do this because I want to further my career or something like that. And someone else can look after my kids for those 8 hours. I'll throw it out there. See how many people we can get upset about that. and then finally, no controversy here as far as I know of, but maybe you can think of something. Apparently in April, there will be a new area code in Alberta.
And this is our fifth now.
This is the fifth one now.
The classic 403, then we went to the 780 and 587.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what the other one was, but there was another one that came in a little while back.
Yeah. I grew up at least, 13, I've been in Alberta more now, but I grew up in BC. I still remember some of the BC area codes that I had growing up there. Yeah. For me here, it's been 403. So I know there's a number of them out there, but again, this is just, they only come out apparently with area codes when they're running out of phone numbers. So either there's a lot of population, but probably just a lot more cell phones.
We've wound up with a lot of dead numbers that haven't been gone through the recycle process yet.
Yeah.
Because you can't immediately reassign numbers. There's certain delays and some numbers that get assigned to something and then they just sit idle. Mm-hmm. And so, eventually you just kind of run out.
Yeah, that'd be so many numbers. How would you keep track of all that?
It's amazing that our phone systems work. We're talking about adding a fifth area code, and the area code is only the first of the 10 digits. So you've got 7 digits after that, and we're running out of that.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I think there's just so much technology that we just take so much for granted, how things just work.
It's no longer somebody sitting at a board and moving wires around to connect you to your call.
Yeah. And everyone shares 5 lines, it's just fascinating to think about the modern conveniences. And I'll use that to segue into kind of the dark end of our wealth and opulence, I guess, in the West.
Yeah. The absurdity of what we now spend money on.
Yes.
That we never would have in years past.
Oh no, of course you were barely trying. You're just trying to make it by to the next day.
Yeah.
And try to keep your family warm in your little 5-room huts. And hopefully your lord didn't come and collect taxes from you before you had collected your harvests. We're not talking about a long time ago when that was the case.
Yeah, but even looking back to the wealthy, it used to be the wealthy would spend on the same things as the poor, but to the extreme. You'd have a bigger, better house. You'd have fancier car. That tended to be the thing. You'd wear a watch, but your watch would be worth $100,000 instead of $20,000.
Yeah. There wasn't as wide of products to choose from. There's a very narrow set of categories of things, and within those categories, you just kind of upgraded up and down the scale here. Nowadays, you can spend money on literally anything you can imagine. Now it seems.
Yeah, categories that I just can't wrap my head around.
So let's start. We'll run through these ones fairly quickly, I think. The first one here, let me bring up the article. So I think a lot of people are aware of how much, land or real estate has gone and boomed, especially in this area, especially in the cities, but even in rural setting, it's gone up, significantly. But apparently that's not enough for some people.
Well, we're running out of real estate. There's just not enough land out there anymore.
Apparently. There's so much not empty space in Canada here. But apparently this the real estate, the real land is not enough for some. They've bought digital land. And here, you know, think of it this way. Think about, I don't know if you're into video games, maybe something like Fortnite. Usually they take place on some sort of limited playing field. So you do have a limited resource.
Yep.
And the idea here is that you can actually buy space on that virtual island, as it were.
Yep.
And you just hopefully people visit you on that virtual island, because usually, you know, they're for a store. You're trying to sell something. The article was kind of comparing this to like buying the land where New York is before New York built up. So you know if you bought that before New York and you tried selling it now, like, you make killing on that money.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of what they're doing here in virtual land. But the difference is you can build many, many virtual New Yorks. And so even though you've bought this virtual land, and we're talking about lots of money, like, so there's this virtual land known as Decentraland.
Mm-hmm.
And someone bought space in there for $2.4 million US. There's another kind of digital land known as the Sandbox. And in a single week last year, they sold over $86 million of land.
Yeah.
in this digital sandbox. This is much, much different than real land. This is like, sure, you know, this video game might take up limited space, but you can build thousands, millions of virtual islands to people visit. So this is a huge gamble. Hope that people visit your digital land.
Yeah, you're really gambling on whether, like you say, Decentraland, you're gambling on that becoming one that holds on as a central location, not just fade away into oblivion.
Yeah, and like most of them are going
to. They may have limited land within it. Like, from what I understand, the Decentraland, it is set up as a limited
space
that can't be expanded. It is designed to be limited so that that land is valuable.
Yep.
But it's still digital, and other people can make a new one.
Yeah. You don't have to add on to the Decentraland. You just build a whole new world.
Yeah, I could make another one that's just a near replica of Decentraland and try selling my land.
Yeah.
So.
But apparently there's a lot of people with a lot of money thinking that this is a good investment.
Well, and I heard one story of a guy buying a chunk of land so that he could live beside a celebrity that owned a chunk of land in it. So you're paying to live near somebody in a virtual space, hoping they don't leave the virtual space.
Because if
you place value on it.
Yeah. Especially if you're looking at it for like a long-term investment, because that's what people are trying, I'm suspecting they're trying to do. They think this is going to be a long-term win in the end. When there's only one New York in the real world, that's something. But here, there's no guarantee that the virtual land you've built is going to be the only island that people go to, if anyone goes to it at all.
Yeah.
So there's a huge, like, and people, like I said, millions of dollars being risked on that gamble. Insane to me. I feel bad buying or spending a couple hundred dollars on some of the technology that we're using to record this, and there's millions of dollars just flying around out there.
Yep.
So that was you know, someone bought some digital land for $2.4 million. Someone built or bought a JPEG, basically. Mm-hmm. So a JPEG is exactly what you get when you take a picture with your cell phone. It's just a kind of a picture format. Someone bought one of these for $69 million. So this is a JPEG, and this is in the kind of the last year's trend, and I guess it's still going on, of NFTs, these non-fungible tokens. You perhaps know a little bit more about these than I do. It seems like scam bait to me, but anyway.
The concept is an absolutely brilliant concept. It's that, like, non-fungible. The design is...
So it can't be changed?
It can't be replicated. It can't be changed. Like, it's set. and it's in the blockchain. It's in a distributed ledger. Everybody has records of this, so you know who owns that token. And this has been, there's been theories thrown around about what this could be used for, and there are places in the world that are using it for land title records and things you don't want to be changeable.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. But then this last year, it took off as a way to sell digital art.
Yes.
And that's where it just went, as far as I'm concerned, it went off the rails. Like, you've got people spending hundreds of thousands into the millions on somebody's digital art, which, great, they put some work into some digital art, but where's the value in it? Yeah, you can say, like, I own it. Everybody sees that I own it.
Yes.
You can make a copy of it, but that's just like, I can have a print of the Mona Lisa. That's not the Mona Lisa. It's different.
Yes.
But
yes,
on a digital scale, yeah, it just goes even more absurd than that. Like, I don't see the value, the extreme value placed on physical art, but digital art, how?
Yeah. At least I can understand, you know, an original painting. Like, there's only one of that thing. There's only one original painting. So yeah, Mona Lisa, sure. There's only one of those. I can buy a poster of it. And I understand that it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
But this $69 million JPEG, it's a collage of 5,000 images of digital images that this digital artist created over the last number of years. But it's a digital image to begin with, and I'm looking at it right now. Like, I can see the image, and how can you tell me that the image I'm looking at is any different than the original digital? Ultimately, I can tell what the difference is between the original print.
The only thing that makes it different is that it is in that blockchain record. There is a non-changeable, like, basically set in stone record that guy owns that the original of that print,
yeah,
that digital thing. There's no other distinguishing feature.
Yes.
So that's where it does become difficult. Why would somebody want to see yours?
Yes. It's the ownership of it that you're selling.
Yeah.
And not the actual product. Because the product I can get. Yeah.
Ultimately, that's what it is. So, like you say, like, people go to a museum to look at these amazing original art pieces.
Yeah, I don't go to my neighbor and look at his poster of the Mona Lisa.
Yeah. Who's going to go to look at this digital thing? Like, you could set up a virtual museum, but why would somebody pay to go into your virtual museum when you can see an exact copy of it? Maybe it's not the original owner, but there's no difference. It's digital.
Yeah,
I can see it on my screen just as well as you can see it on your screen.
Yeah. I just don't get it.
But like I said, the concept started really strong. That non-fungible token idea, that ability to have records that are unchangeable, and this is
the same technology that goes with, like, Bitcoin and digital currency.
Yeah.
But
the idea can go beyond currency into things like, this token represents this piece of land, and nobody can change that ownership until you have legally transferred that ownership. You can't fake it.
Yes. And so I guess it provides a security to something, like, you know, like you said, ownership to something. It secures you as the owner that can't be changed, but
we're using it
when, but when it comes to taking, or especially visual things, like, part of that is the fact that if I have something now I have the ability to show it to you or not. I have a car, and it's not available for everyone.
Yeah.
I own it, but I also have power over people using it.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you don't really have any power over people using that image still.
Yeah.
Crazy. It was like you said, $69 million. Just basically for the ownership deed to an image that you can enjoy in the exact same way as the owner can. Okay. I don't have $69 million to spend on it that way. I just don't see how that makes sense or is any way justified. All right. Couple other quick ones here. Perhaps you played Super Mario. I'm sure you probably have especially if you lived in North America. And Super Mario has been around for years. Super Mario 64 was kind of the first 3D version of him, of the game, and that was for the Nintendo 64. And you can probably go on Facebook and Marketplace and type in Super Mario 64 and find it being sold. There was apparently 11 million, almost 12 million of versions of these game of this game sold.
I have a copy sitting at home, and I'm pretty sure I paid about $20 for it.
Okay, so there you go. So there's 12 million of these things that were produced. Someone bought one of them for $1.5 million last summer. And it was in the same auction as one that was sold for $13,000. The only difference was that one was given a quality rating of 9.6. That was only worth $13,000. The other one was given a quality rating of 9.8, and that was worth $1.5 million.
Oh man.
I don't know. This feels more like the scene from Dark Knight.
Where he's just burning the money.
He's burning money now. Like that's all it looks like. That's what comes to mind. It's just a pile of money burning. Like there's no way you make money off of that.
We live in an age of absurd nostalgia. We look at these things and place values on them that make no logical sense. Not even that old. Like Super Mario 64,
96? I was six.
So yeah, I would have been. I was a young kid, but
this 1996.
This isn't old. This isn't something from 100 years ago.
It's 25 years. It's yeah, only 25 years old.
That's. How do you place value like that on a 25-year-old video game cartridge?
A lot of rich, nostalgic young people now. Yep. At least that's what's one of the auction houses we're saying. Because there in that same auction. No, it was actually a couple days earlier. It broke there is a record set for video games. I think it was somewhere in the 800,000 range for a 1989 version of a Zelda game. So 1989, I'm guessing, I didn't look up to see what system that was. I'm assuming it's Nintendo.
Man, mine aren't in great condition, but I should really hold on
to
those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, if do not open the packaging if you have it in the packaging. So just leave it there. And go may raid your attic. Yeah. your parents' attic. Yeah.
If your parents or grandparents have anything sitting in their attic.
All right, I'll breeze through this one. Tesla, speaking of ridiculous. I just bring this one up because it has some just fun stats on this. So Tesla stock is now worth, the company is now worth over $1 trillion. It started last year at merely $650 million. Billion. $650 billion. And at that point, it was already worth the next 9 car makers combined. So Chevy, Ford, I'm assuming like Mercedes, Benz, Toyota, like probably the top 9 that you can name. They're all, yeah. Tesla is worth more than them.
Combined.
Like that's,
and if you know anything about Teslas, you know how bad they are at keeping up with orders.
Yeah.
They're not able to even supply the small numbers that they're trying to supply.
Yes. Yeah, so last year they sold 500,000 vehicles across the world. 500,000. Just as a comparison, Ford sold 1.2 million vehicles, and they're only valued at $80 billion. So Tesla is worth over 10 times that, while selling a mere fraction of the cars. So just as a valuation, I thought it was kind of interesting. So if you just take the $1 trillion number and divide it by 500,000 cars, you come up with a valuation of $24 million per car.
Wow, most expensive supercar on the market.
That's crazy. If you're thinking of getting in on that, check that the batteries run in the cold. I've seen some news stories that's just nothing.
After this cold snap we've had, I'm not sure I'd be wanting to run an electric car.
Yeah. All right. So let's finish up with a good news story. And perhaps you already heard this. It has been making the rounds around mainstream media. I first picked it up kind of in my sports circles. But there is a hockey game in Seattle. So Seattle Kraken is kind of the newest NHL team and really a top candidate for the best logo in the league. It's worth checking out the Seattle Kraken logo. But anyways, Vancouver Canucks were making their first visit to Seattle to play the Kraken on October 23rd. And their assistant equipment manager, Brian Red Hamilton, was behind the bench as he usually is. And while he was standing behind the bench, there was an observant young lady who was checking him out, but not in that way. She was looking at a particular spot on the back of his neck. It was a mole. And she thought it had the kind of the signs of a cancerous mole, kind of a melanoma. And so she tries to get the assistant manager's attention while he's on the bench. And you can imagine what what Hamilton is, the equipment manager's thinking. Like, here you are in a strange building surrounded by, you know, enemy fans, and you have this lady on the front, banging on the glass trying to get your attention. and you probably just going to largely ignore it. But what she ended up doing is she typed out the message on her phone saying something like the mole on the back of your neck looks probably cancerous. You should get it checked out. And she holds that up to the window on the glass, and the assistant manager sees it. But of course, you know, what are you going to do? It's a stranger putting up a curious message, if nothing else. But he's kind of
pass it off as a joke or like somebody just pestering
serious do you take medical advice from strangers?
Yeah.
Like, come on.
You just kind of ignore that.
Yeah. So anyways, he gets home from the road trip and he asks his wife to check it out for him. In fact, he doesn't even aware that he has a mole on the back of his neck, apparently.
Oh, man.
Like, because really, who checks there? Yeah. Like,
it'd be easy to miss.
It's not something that you're usually seeing in the mirror. But yeah, his wife checks it out. The team doctor takes a look. They end up removing the mole and getting a biopsy. And it turns out it's actually malignant. So this young lady was correct. And her name is Nadia Popovici. And the reason we know her name is because about 2 months after the October game, Canucks were coming back January 1st. And it was on January 1st that the Canucks tweeted out a message from the equipment manager looking for the young lady who was behind the bench at the Seattle game to thank her for basically saving his life. Because if this doesn't get spotted within a few years, who knows what that melanoma does?
Like, yeah, it could spreads. Could have spread. Yeah. And could have been disastrous.
Yeah, like especially a mole, like easy to miss, easy to pass off as insignificant. But they sent out a tweet January 1st because Canucks were going to be back in Seattle for a game. In 2 hours, the internet and I gotta say, this is probably one of the best things about the internet is this kind of crowdsourcing of people.
For all the bad things the internet does, when you call out to Twitter or Reddit or Facebook to find somebody for you or to help somebody out, it is amazing what a lot of random strangers can pull together and do.
Yeah, they find anybody, it seems, in a matter of hours. In this case, it took them about 2 hours. Nadia's mom actually came across the tweet or became aware of it. Nadia was apparently sleeping. I think she'd been working the night before. She tweeted out that she'll tell her daughter. And her daughter was planning to be at the game. Apparently they have season tickets. and so the good news story is that through this, Hamilton is able to meet Paul Vici. There's some great images on Twitter with them engaged or hugging, meeting each other. It's just a wonderful story. It's topped all off by the fact that in the middle of the game, there's an announcement that's made that Nadia is going to receive a $10,000 scholarship thanks to the Canucks and the Kraken teaming up and providing scholarship. Apparently she's a medical student who had recently been accepted into some medical schools. And so this is obviously going to go a long ways to help her out. But it's one of those just real personal stories out there, a real good human connection kind of stories.
Yeah.
That show that there's still a lot of good. You really gotta see it. The image of them hugging, you can like the equipment manager is just giving you like the biggest bear hug. Like, this isn't one of those dainty, I'm scared of COVID for perhaps kind
he was
of
sincerely like, oh, grateful. Like
this was, yeah, it was a full on embrace. It was such a just a touching image. Yeah. So I guess what kind of came to mind was in the Bible we're told not to worry about the speck in our brother's eye, but if you see a suspicious mole on his back of his neck,
help him out.
Yeah, it might may give him a kind of a heads up there. And I guess I think this story is getting around. I think probably a lot of people have heard it. I want just for a moment, put yourself in Nadia's shoes. Even if you have a little bit of medical training, which it seems she already has, how readily are you going to take the chance and step out and tell a complete stranger that they should get that mole checked out? It might be cancerous. Like, are you really going to be brave enough to do that?
The number of excuses we would make to ourselves to not do it.
Yeah.
You think, well, he's probably already had it checked out, or that's not my problem, or he's not going to listen to me anyway, or there's so many excuses we would just make to say, no, it's none of my business. Leave it alone.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of the mentality that kind of goes, everyone mind their own business. Or at least sort of out there. But yeah, I don't know, that might be perhaps the most remarkable thing out there. It's not that she correctly diagnosed him, but she had the I guess social bravery. Like, for me, I would just be embarrassed to take that step and perhaps be wrong, and then I'd rationalize, yeah, you know, there's tons of doctors around here. This is a professional sports team. They got people checking people out all the time.
Yeah.
What's the point? But yeah, no, good on her. Good on the Canucks and the Kraken for rewarding Nadia. Who knows what that will lead to down the road for her. But hopefully that ends the episode on an uplifting note. So I guess the moral is, make sure you're paying attention to those proverbial moles on your neighbors around you. Perhaps you'll be able to help them out in an unexpected way. But thank you for joining us along this the journey. I know we hit a lot of points. I hope you found it entertaining. My name is Brian Constantine.
I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.